My name's Phil Zimmerman. I'm a comedian and an actor. I write songs as well. Being on this side of the fence in terms of how I see the whole COVID saga, it's been really a constant production line, really, of material. And to be honest, I have to really sort of have periods when I just don't look at stuff because I'm getting so many ideas for taking the piss out of Boris Johnson. It's just too much, you know. So I have been doing gigs. I have done gigs. I've done some live gigs and I've done some online gigs. The downside, obviously, is I was going to do the Edinburgh Festival this year, and obviously that got wiped out. I also run a stall at the Glastonbury Festival. I've been doing that since 2013. That's obviously been wiped out as well. I run a Buddhist stall there because I'm part of a Buddhist movement for peace, education, and culture. So that it's all very much tied up, you know, with being an activist as well, you know. Oh, the other thing was that before I did that, I was a journalist. I was a sports writer, a football writer, and I used to specialise in covering goalless draws. You know, got sent to all the best matches. My proudest boast is that I managed to send Norwich and Ipswich down, wipe out East Anglia in the same season. So yeah, that was fun.
Couldn't you look, as someone that's been involved in this world, obviously you've not been able to do the as much acting. Nobody has really.
No.
It's so what do you make of the, because this is an often forgotten aspect of all of this, whilst we're constantly talking about all these various sort of clinical measures, statistics, is the absolute wipeout of the cultural industries.
Well, it's absolutely tragic. I mean, if you look at the theatre side of it, I mean, that's really been really devastating for, you know, actors that are mainly that's what they mainly do. I mean, I mainly do film and TV things, and one of the things that's a bit lucky about that is that the film industry, like a military operation, really was had to put loads of measures in place, and it got to the point where they were it was kind of, you know, possible to continue even at the highest sort of, you know, highest sort of level of lockdown. So, but I mean, having said that, I've only done, you know, a couple few not many jobs at all, you know. So
Well,
it's
that's, that is immediately makes me think, well, if you've got a massive high budget film, you can do it. If it's something which is a little bit more out there, experimental, etc., and maybe more watchable, not to, you know, because I just find most of this Hollywood stuff absolutely unwatchable. You know, so much of the lower budget stuff is simply not going to be able to happen.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and you better not watch me in Tim Burton's Dumbo then. That's not going to be up your street, Tony, I don't think. But yes, you know, you're absolutely right. It's for every, I mean, for small businesses and obviously small film productions as well. I mean, things like that. It's absolutely devastating. It's like you say, it's been wiped out, and you know, just getting a job, any kind of job, is a bit of a miracle, really. You know.
So we're in a situation where I guess, you know, the only drama about really has been stuff that you can sit and watch on the TV if you can't go to a theatre. And of course, that's in a bit of a terrible state anyway. So look, before we get into talking about this March, can you just give us your take just generally on the state of TV drama, TV, you know, this sort of state for me anyway? It's something which is I've never seen it quite so appalling. I mean, most of it is dull, unwatchable, repetitive, hackneyed. You know, there's a lot of it is really, really heavily over edited, so there's no long shots. It's just like 20 shots of the same person from different angles before they've even finished the sentence. Just give us your take as someone that's involved in this on TV drama these days.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't. I mean, I haven't done a lot of TV work recently. You know, I've done a few movies and stuff, but To give you an indication of what of that, I don't actually own a TV, so I don't watch it. I basically don't watch it, you know, which I shouldn't really admit being an actor. I should be doing research, shouldn't I? But I agree that the quality is low, and I think there's a lot of negativity in it, and it's not very inspiring. Obviously, you get some productions which are, you know, stand out, which are different. But I mean, yes, I just think that the whole direction things are going in is not in the direction of uplifting, inspiring, productions of integrity that are about, creating a better world, you know.
It's not fun either to watch, you know. I certainly remember I was brought up with TV and film in the 70s, 80s, even early 90s. It was actually fun to watch. You think, yeah, crikey, what's going to happen next? And it drew you in. Today does the opposite to me.
I remember when you know, you'd even watch the adverts, and they were like pieces of art. They were funny and they were artistic. And it reminded me the other day when I had a chance to ride on an old... one of the old buses, you know, they hauled them out for a day out. It was from the 1950s, and it was kind of beautiful, you know, just being on there. They had the conductor on there, and the bell, and the adverts were even sort of beautiful. They looked beautiful, you know. It just had a different quality about it. But now we seem to be moving into an era where everything is becoming faster and faster, shallower and shallower. More and more superficial, and we're going, it seems to me, in a direction that is anti-human, anti-nature.
No, I agree. Back in the 90s, or maybe it was the early noughties, I went along to something called Bristol Media, which was it was a big conference. You could join this organisation for free. And there was a handful of journalists there, but the whole thing was dominated by marketing. Yes. And billboard advertising executives, and they literally saw the broadcast media journalists as people who would just repeat what they wanted to say. And you know, if you're looking at a lot of the drama, it seems to be driven by whatever adverts are going to go next to it and whoever's funding it, rather than, you know, any kind of interest in what the viewers and listeners want to see.
Yes, well, I think, you know, we're talking about a pandemic or a plague. We're seeing in not just in drama, but in all areas of life, really, this kind of suffocation of, you know, anything natural, anything that's quality or inspiring or useful, by these corporate men, faceless corporate men in suits, you know, of which Bill Gates is the great emperor, you know. but this is something that, I mean, I noticed it. There was a certain point, I don't know how many years, about 10 or more years ago, and I just suddenly started to become aware that the language was changing, that this kind of corporate speak started to seep into the language. And then you just gradually became aware of the fact that these corporations are just casting a shadow over everything. And now, of course, it's got to the point where it's absolutely palpable and obvious what's going on and who's controlling things, and that, you know, the center of gravity has drifted away from government to these think tanks and bodies like, you know, the World Economic Forum, Davos, Bilderberg, all this type of thing. And we need to wrest back control. And I mean, the one of the wonderful things about the demo I went to on Saturday, having been to most of the demos in London since they started, and the first one was only a few hundred there, but it was to see such a huge crowd. And it's been building actually since October. It was a really wonderful one in October, and then it all went quiet for a good while because the police just destroyed everything. But on Saturday, there were so many people there, and it was such an incredible... It was like being human again and being allowed to be human and allowed to be around other great people and communicate. And it was a really joyful, joyful event.
Okay, well, look, before you give us a good old description of Saturday, can you just tell us what drew you into the movement in the first place?
Well, I was on the Iraq march in, was it 2002, 2003? The anti-Iraq war march, and that was, I suppose, one of the first things that kind of awakened me towards becoming an activist. But the thing which, are you referring to this particular movement? What made?
Well, I mean about, you know, okay. So there's a pandemic announced March 2020. Yeah. You know, there's, and I suppose some people just have gone along with it and, you know, decided that they'll do whatever they're told by the TV people. Mm. But others have kind of railed against it and said, well, actually, this isn't making any sense.
Yeah, well, the significant thing for me was getting a Mac, getting a computer about 2010, and sort of studying what's going on in the world and not listening, you know, not listening to the mainstream media. I'd always felt, even as a kid watching the BBC News, I'd watch it and feel uncomfortable and not really know why I was feeling uncomfortable. But the thing which immediately, having already been attuned to that, and done sort of 10 years work on it, when I, early on in the pandemic, in inverted commas, it was apparent immediately to me that they were inflating the death figures. And there was an article in The Spectator by a pathologist, saying, and the headline was, the way that we are counting the COVID death toll is a national disgrace. The headline was something like that. And I knew straight away that something wasn't right. And I just kept watching it, really, all the way through. And it's just got worse and worse. And, that's just the way it's developed. But, I mean, the other significant thing I would say is that when we were 8 months in, we had 8 months of knowledge about lockdowns, and they brought in the second lockdown. That's when I absolutely knew this is serious, because this is not a mistake anymore. This is deliberate.
That's the Halloween lockdown, isn't it? I remember it was a Saturday, Halloween. You never get government announcements on a Saturday evening. Mm. And it was literally the Halloween moon was rising behind Boris's head as he was announcing that there was going to be another lockdown.
Oh, really?
I think, you know, yeah, wow. I just thought this is kind of taking the mickey, really. But anyhow, I mean, to some people it would be significant, to other people it's just coincidence, or other people wouldn't necessarily notice it at all. But look, I mean, things have moved on a bit since then, and I think you're not the only one that's been made aware over the winter of the idea that a lockdown might work. Well, it clearly obviously doesn't, and yet there is even consideration now that there might be more lockdowns. We don't know, but we know they don't work. That's one thing we do know. Can you just take us through what time it got started on Saturday, where you were, and take us through the day?
Yeah, I was got to make some new friends through this whole protest movement thing, and I was meeting a friend that's coming down from Cornwall, and some other friends as well. So met up in Hyde Park, and actually we were walking from Marble Arch, and then what was interesting and new was, as we were walking across the park trying to figure out where the march is starting from, there was a sound that I hadn't heard before any of the other ones. It was like a roar and a whistle and a powerful pulsating sound. And that, and is that the march? I said, yeah, it is. You know, so it already started, and it was powered up, you know, in a way that none of the other ones were quite like that, you know. So that was how it started. And then as the march wore on, I mean, we just met up with there's a friend of mine that is really funny. He always he's from Sweden. He always turns up. It doesn't matter how many thousands of people are in the crowd, all of a sudden you just find him casually wandering up and saying hi, you know. And then he always knows about six or seven other people or more in the crowd that he just happens to meet. So it's really funny. But there's a kind of community building there of people that always see each other on these marches. But the thing that was noticeable was the police were very, there's a very minimal police presence, and their body language was not in any way aggressive. They were just letting it happen. They were there on duty doing their job, like the police should be doing, you know, on hand in case they needed, you know. So no problems, great atmosphere, music, people singing, brilliant banners, just a great, vibrant, you know, expression. And the next one is on May the 15th. So I really encourage anyone that hasn't been yet and wants to come not to be afraid. There is no outdoor transmission of the virus as far as we can tell. The government SAGE advisor said that there was no transmission from the massive crowds that were packed onto beaches last summer. And with this whole movement, you know, as I say, you know, I don't know anyone. We all meet up every time. No mass die-offs from it. So it's a great day out. And it's
can you give us any idea of roughly how many people were there?
Well, it's very difficult to say. There's an article, it's a really good article on Sputnik News. And what does it say here? He says that Saturday's March was the largest, this is Neil Clark, Saturday's March was the largest demonstration I have seen since the one before the Iraq War, which I also attended. As the data analyst and system journalist Philip Watson commented, so great were the numbers in attendance that none of the footage was able to capture the beginning and end of the crowds that thronged the streets, a feat that even an airborne drone couldn't accomplish. So that puts it very well. I would reckon there must be 500,000 at least. I mean, some people are saying a million. It's by far the biggest, by far.
Okay, so what was the rough route around London? And what were we talking about in terms of timing? When did it start and finish?
Oh, that's it went from Hyde Park to Speaker's Corner, down the embankment, back to Hyde Park again, Parliament Square. Somebody said it was the march was 9 miles long. The last one, similar route to the last one, and it was quite a long march actually. I don't know how many miles, but it was pretty long, pretty exhausting. But
and can you give us an idea of some of the different groups? Because I know there's a whole load. There's Piers Corbyn, he's probably the most outspoken, but then there's also the Stand Up group, Save Our Rights. Can you give us an idea of the range of different aspects to this movement?
Well, I mean, It's just a real cross section of people. I mean, from all ages, all races, all backgrounds. It's just a melting pot of humanity there. There's no, you couldn't categorize what type of, I mean, you know, the media tries to smear it as you know, crazy conspiracy theorist and you know, disgraceful headlines like anti-vaxxer thugs and this type of thing, which is in the Metro, really disgraceful. It's just a wonderful kind of party atmosphere with all different types of people, children, you know. And there was a 100-year-old man there on Saturday marching, you know, and he'd fought in the war, you know, incredible. Just a great kind of mixture, really.
Now, I've also seen some of the people marching along with you were these Kill the Bill people. So there's obviously a focus, you know, you're providing there a focus for people when on a weekend when a particular part of the social movements of today doesn't have a march, they can kind of join in on someone else's.
Well, yes. I mean, Save Your Rights were kind of at the forefront at one point. And you know, but I think it's more about, yeah, it doesn't really matter who organises it. The main thing is that people turn up, you know, and, you know, that's a fantastic thing that we had so many people there on Saturday.
OK, what about the end of it, though? Because I know that there was a few problems with the police. They turned a little bit, you know, they were smiling at the beginning, but they started frowning towards the end.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering if there is some kind of overarching policy for the police on these things, or if there's some rogue elements, or if there is just an idea that we'll let this happen and then we'll do the usual routine at the end. Because, well, I've seen three attacks on the public by the police at these demonstrations in London. Two of them were at Trafalgar Square, where there was like a pincer movement, really, of squadrons that moved in at the top of the square and attack the public. And there were women getting kicked and hit by truncheons and things. That was in the first two Trafalgar Square ones. That was, and they both happened during, just at a moment when there were speakers that were getting the crowd quite excited and passionate, you know. And it was, I noticed that it was on both occasions there, it was at that moment that the order was given. Very strange, because again, perfectly peaceful, nothing happening, and they just, it all kicked off from the police moving in. On Saturday, what happened was we finished up at Hyde Park, and then there wasn't a massive crowd there. It was a nice chilled out crowd, and there was a musical, there was a band playing, and there was a crowd of a few hundred people gathered around the band. It was very peaceful, playing along. And then all of a sudden, a squadron of police just moved in, stormed in, and were pushing and grabbing people. It was very shocking. It just happened out of nothing. There was no announcement given. There was nothing on the loudhailer like, we now want you to disperse. Nothing like that. It was just an unprovoked attack without any warning. And, things kicked off a bit from there. It was just pointless. And you have to wonder, why they did that, what they thought they could get out of that, what they were trying to achieve. The only thing I can see, and it's the thing we knew would happen because it always does, is that it gave the media, the photographers that were there, the opportunity to smear the whole day, you know. And like I mentioned earlier, disgraceful headlines in the Metro and probably elsewhere as well, saying anti-vaxxer thugs. We're not anti-vaxxers. I'm not an anti-vaxxer, you know. And that just seems to have been an opportunity that the police created to smear people, you know, that were there, who were just taking part in a relaxing evening. You know?
Yeah, I suppose, if you're thinking about the times of where the news bulletins are on the TV and the radio, you've got, everything that's been attempted to be achieved during the day is suddenly trounced, really, by, oh, gosh, there's been an outbreak of violence. So that's what the press often tends to report.
Exactly, yeah. And and what they also said in the press coverage was, 8 police officers injured. There was one police officer in particular who had a bloody eye, and then we saw the picture that was everywhere, of blood trickling down his face. It looks, if you look at the picture, I don't know if you've seen it, Tony, but as I say, I'm an actor, I've been in horror films, and I know what fake blood looks like, you know. It looked to me more akin to the stuff that I've had put on me in horror films than it did anything that might happen there that Saturday evening.
Well, hang on. How can you tell the difference?
Well, it was very, the blood that he had. You see, I'm wondering when this blood, the blood as it appears in the press pictures, when it arrived on his face in that manner. Because of the video of the whole incident, several videos, but there's one very good video of it, and you can quite clearly see that it's just, the blood is in his eye socket. Okay, now the picture in the paper, the blood starts to trickle down. It's coming down from his forehead, but then it goes into a very elaborate lattice work of parallel lines down his cheek, and he's got a blue mask sort of propped under his chin, but there's no blood on the mask, and it just looks very sus to me. Like they sort of put a bit of extra on him afterwards for the cameras. I mean, that's how it looks to me, you know, and that would fit with the whole agenda.
You know, you've been looking at trying to compile some of the main points as to why people should be paying attention to what's going on at the moment. Do you want to just run through some of those for us?
Yeah, well, I mean, another thing sort of right from the start, really, was the PCR test. You know, the PCR test is really the central thing about the whole rollout of the lockdown policy worldwide. And if you look up Rainer Fulmich, I don't know if you know him, the German lawyer, he's working with a team of lawyers to bring out a class action lawsuit, and they will be focusing on the fraudulent use of the PCR test. Because the PCR test, it has a high false positive rate, and if it's used above, I think it's like 30 or 32 magnifications, and then it gives false positives, and apparently it's being used at 40, 45 in this country. And the other thing is, which is absolutely crucial, is that it cannot test for infectiousness. So it cannot establish infectiousness. It doesn't do that, wasn't designed to do that. Carrie Mallis, its inventor, stated that. And if you go on the Public Health England website, it's stated there. It cannot do that. Also, you can find it in a Reuters fact check article. And the World Health Organization finally came out after over a year on January 13th, and they stated, although in a rather arcane manner, that that's the case as well. There's a problem with the PCR test. So, I mean, everything is based on you know, the PCR test, and they say if you test positive, you're infectious. That's not true. And the other thing, of course, connected to that is the way that fear has been used, right? And the government's SAGE team, there is a document in a policy document where they actually state that they need to ramp up the fear more, because certain members of the public are not afraid enough, have to increase the fear level. So that's actually a stated policy. And if you think about what happened around the springtime, because we had March and we had April when the death rates were high, and then and that was a pretty scary time. But then when we got into the spring and then summer, the death rates started to fall. And what I noticed, it was very noticeable around that time that the media, having, you know, fed us this fear about the rising death toll, they never once did you hear that the death toll was coming down. Now, it wasn't something that was a message in the media. You didn't see that graph falling, never saw it, and we never heard about, oh, there's just two deaths today or there's no deaths today. But what you did hear then was, into that vacuum, they mandated the masks. They brought in mask wearing for public transport and supermarkets. And then you started to hear about cases. They drip fed that into our consciousness, cases. And then cases became soaring infections, all based on the PCR test, a test which cannot test for the virus. So in that way, they kept the fear factor going through the spring and the summer, until they got back to the flu season in the autumn.
Well, yeah, and they also, it was part one of the reasons why we were booted off of FM, supposedly, although, of course, there's lots of other political reasons why someone might want to get rid of somebody like me from their radio station, especially if they're friends with the Blairite mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees. It's the Ofcom guidance. Now, that was also aimed fairly and squarely at editors and managers of radio stations and TV stations across the country, saying, you will be taking very special measures to make sure that messages which counteract the government's official scientific policy are challenged or not given any airtime. Otherwise, you may lose your license. So this is an absolute threat. Now, of course, we know now for certain that much of the government scientific, so-called scientific advice, was killing people. So this is what Ofcom's role now seems, is as a sort of enforcer of mass murder, when you've got the prohibition of the use of treatments like ivermectin and chloroquine, which have got anything up to 90% recovery rates against control groups in proper official scientific surveys. They're not allowed to be talked about, apparently, according to Ofcom. So that also is extremely. I think this is unprecedented, Phil. What do you think?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned ivermectin. I totally agree. I mean, the levels of censorship, talking about what got me into it at the start, the other thing was, of course, starting to see, wow, we're getting censored. People, doctors, eminent scientists and doctors, as well as, you know, just members of the public and whoever wants to, you know, put out a different idea than the official narrative, was being censored. And you started to ask yourself, well, why is this? Why have we got censorship? And because what I would have thought, if we had a level playing field, as the whole issue of the vaccine became, you know, the central focus, why wouldn't we have an open debate, a series of open debates and programs on live TV for all of the information to be thoroughly put before the public, and so that anyone could make up their mind? And I think that's called, going back to the Nuremberg trials after the war and the Nuremberg Code, I believe that's called, informed consent. And that's a human right. And what's happening now, as far as I can gather, with the rollout of the vaccines, vaccines in inverted commas, by the way, because they don't seem to do what vaccines are supposed to do, although the government's saying they do now for 46% of the people. But anyway, that was really a scary thing to see, that that was happening. And people that are having the vaccine now, I've asked several people I know, my friends that have had it, and I've asked them, were you told that this vaccine is an experimental medical procedure? Because that's what the Nuremberg Code states, that as a result of the experiments were done on the Jews, they brought in this law against human experimentation. That any experimental procedure that is carried out on a human being, that person has to be fully informed about it. And people aren't being told that this vaccine is experimental. And they're not being told that it's being administered under emergency use authorization. Therefore, it has not been licensed. It has not been approved. And the earliest time that it can be licensed is going to be 2023, could up to 2025, depending on which vaccine we're talking about, you know?
So, yeah, well, look, Phil, the main giveaway for me is being the indemnity that the government has have to give to the entire, you know, the multi-billion, trillion-dollar pound pharmaceutical industry for any after effects, any ill effects that the vaccines have. So, for example, if somebody who is under 60 in good health has a vaccine and dies, then they have to then take the government to court rather than the pharmaceutical company that supplied the vaccine.
That's right. That's been the case in the States in 86, isn't it? The same thing there. I mean, yeah, they're not responsible for their own product. They don't have the confidence to, they've got to be in the, I mean, that started in America because they had so many lawsuits that they said to the government, we can't continue unless you help us out, you know. So yeah, I mean, they're not prepared to stand up and take responsibility for the safety of their product. So,
well, I suppose that any self-respecting government should stand up to these guys and say, well, you know, tough, if your vaccines are killing people, I'm afraid we're not bailing you out.
Exactly, yeah. They don't seem to care about that. And with ivermectin, all these studies, Tess Laurie, who's from the School of Evidence-Based Medicine in Oxford, I think it's Oxford, she's done a meta-study.
No, she's in Bath, actually, yeah.
Oh, is it Bath? Yeah, sorry. Yeah, she's done a meta-study of all the studies on ivermectin and sent it to Matt Hancock. And just silence is the response, you know. And it's, as you say, it's safe. I think the problem with it, it's too safe. It's too cheap. It's too effective. It's not good for big pharma, is it? It's not going to help them make money.
And I suppose the thing is that the pharmaceutical industry sort of bamboozled everybody with this way over the top response in March and April last year in 2020. And they are onto such, I mean, they're obviously looking at the returns. They're even talking now, Phil, aren't they, about having, you know, booster shots, yearly COVID vaccines rather like the flu vaccine. Now, that's going to be an absolute bonanza, especially if no one's going to be able to have their freedom back until they've had one of these vaccine passports.
Exactly, yeah. And they keep moving the goalposts. They were telling us for months and months that the vaccine is the promised land. You'll be able to get everything back to normal. And then they just change it. They keep changing everything. You can't trust a single thing they say. It's, you know, it's ludicrous.
Right, well, where do you think that this whole thing is heading? Obviously, there's going to be more marches and things like that.
Yeah, the next one, as I say, is on May the 15th. Spread the word. Get to London on May the 15th. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a... Where's it going? I mean, we have to just... We just have to say no. I mean, no is a really powerful word. I mean, there's been a lot of compliance up to now, you know? And if we... I mean, they can only carry out tyranny against the people if the people acquiesce with it, right?
What about the Great Reset, though? That's it seems to me almost audacious, really, to come up with a major crisis, but then also, literally, as the major crisis is beginning to unfold, you've already got your kind of solution, which is to reset the world economy.
Well, yes, it's pretty blatant, isn't it? And I mean, it seems to be now, this seems to be morphing into the climate change agenda as well. There was a hidden camera video taken of a CNN, I think a producer, and he was talking about how soon that the COVID agenda is going to kind of fade away, and they're going to be talking about the climate change thing. And I've seen stories about the lockdowns for climate change has been mentioned now. So it's all connected. And, you know, who elects these people? Who elected Bill Gates? Who elected Klaus Schwab, to be, assigned to positions of power to decide how we live our lives and how we conduct our health and all this type of stuff? I mean, this quote of is it by 2030 you'll own nothing and you'll be happy, you know. I think that might only be 50% true. You know, you'll own nothing and you won't be happy. And they'll say, oh, well, at least you were half right, you know.
Yeah, so long as you tell everyone you're happy, you'll be happy, even if you've got nothing. You know, it's getting into a kind of very... Well, actually, it's almost more Brave New World than the New World Order type of, you know, the Orwellian stuff. Anyway, look, Phil, we obviously all need to switch the TVs off when it comes to the news and get our information from more reliable sources. Have you got any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, the UK column is really on a crest of a wave, and that's growing fast, and it's doing better programs. The UK column, I think, is excellent. I recommend that. They have three broadcasts a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. They do a live broadcast at 1 o'clock. The government, you could tell they're doing well because the government are trying to shut them down. They're being taken off YouTube for just broadcasting an account of a woman whose husband had suffered severe effects from having the vaccine. They're trying to clamp down the UK column. The High Wire, Del Bigtree's High Wire, is another thing I highly recommend. That's a show every Thursday. And really great journalism. He's been doing some great stuff on this issue. Check out Rainer Fulmich, the German lawyer. He's fantastic too. He puts out lots of videos. He's going into great depths, interviewing lots of people about this. And hopefully their lawsuit is gonna get somewhere. Let's keep our fingers crossed. The Corbett Report as well is another excellent one, and the 21st Century Wire. I'm sure you've got more that you could recommend.
Well, yeah. Also, I mean, you talked about Del Bigtree there. Reminds me of Ian Brown and his song, which is actually called Big Tree. I think he's a nod and a wink to Del Bigtree, actually. and the High Wire, and from amazing, really. I think it was the Stone Roses, he was the lead singer of. We also had Van Morrison churning out this stuff, but of course none of it played on the mass media, really. Are there any other sort of musical, uplifting musical anti-lockdown? Because this has really just been totally and utterly stifled, and I don't think it's been deliberately censored. I think it's just that the producers, the schedulers, the researchers, etc., are self-censoring. They know that this is not the right message, it's the wrong story, and they'd probably get a sack if they were to put Ian Brown's Little Tree, what it was called, Big Tree, I can't remember now, or Van Morrison's anti-lockdown song on their channel.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, I think there's a hell of a lot of self-censoring going on. You know, I'm sure that applies to the mask thing as well. You know, I'm sure there's lots of people that wouldn't wear a mask, you know, they don't believe in it, right? But they're just wearing it because of, they're afraid of rebelling, you know. I'm sure there must be a lot of, I don't know of any other, the same thing applies to comedy. I don't know of any many music acts other than the ones that you've mentioned, the well-known ones that are speaking out. I know, Noel Gallagher did make some noises, didn't he? But I don't think he followed up on it. We need to get more comedians and musicians. To put on events, you know. It's great that Ian Brown said he will never perform at an event where you have to have proof that you've been vaccinated.
Well, there is certainly, in a way, these are the real leaders, aren't they? We can forget our Borises and the rest of them who just seem there to, they're just doing PR, really, aren't they, for the pharmaceutical industries and the trillions of vaccines and mRNA, Pfizer. As another side of this, finally, which is I found quite interesting, is there was an enormous surge in AstraZeneca take up as people started to figure out in sort of February, March, April that we're into now, 2021, that there were all sorts of questions about these mRNA vaccines, these new type of vaccines, supposed vaccines anyway. For the Pfizer and Moderna ones, which would have been, they've been trying to get these things licensed for about 15 years and failed, because there is all sorts of very serious clinical questions about whether they give you some kind of autoimmune disease, maybe even up to 10 years down the line.
Yeah, because what it's doing is it's priming, right?
Well, that's right. It's going into your cells and staying there in some cases. And sometimes those cells might be in your liver, kidneys, places like that, and still sitting there either regularly or maybe just with the potential to churn out the COVID spike protein, which is obviously not very good for you, and then you find your body attacking itself. So as this news came out, as these vaccines became better known in 2021, there was a massive fall off in the take-up of those ones and an increase in people asking for the AstraZeneca. And then suddenly, as a more traditional alternative type, even though, of course, it is itself experimental still. So, and then all of a sudden we get all these news stories about the AstraZeneca one being dangerous and, various countries won't use it. And very little news, by the way, about European countries which are now taking up the Russian Sputnik vaccine because they believe that's the safest.
Oh, right. Yeah, I hadn't heard about that. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, it got to the point, didn't it? Was it 21 countries had either suspended or banned the AstraZeneca? But we didn't, of course, because we're not too bothered about things like health and safety over here.
Well, a point I'm trying to make is that I think that this is a marketing thing by Pfizer, is that the people are losing interest and they don't believe the Pfizer one is safe. And so we start getting scare stories in the media, unquestioned by journalists, of how terrible the AstraZeneca one is. But anyway, you know, this idea of sort of vaccine wars, I find almost amusing if it wasn't so horrific. Anyway, Phil Zimmerman, yes, exactly. Have you got a sort of social channel or anything like that you'd like to plug finally?
Well, I'm on Facebook. I don't really use social media that much. I am on Twitter, Zim Philemon. Yeah, I'm on Facebook as well. I'm doing a comedy gig at the Grove in Hammersmith in London. I think it's a comedy festival the week of the 21st of May. I think I'm doing the 28th of May. So I'll be getting some laughs out of this, okay? There's definitely going to be laughs. It's going to be Boris Johnson impressions, and there's going to be a lot of lockdown laughter. So we can get laughs out of this, definitely, like you just suggested. And we have to, otherwise we go mad, right?
The Grove in Hammersmith, now that's a famous place where the KGB used to meet up with the Cambridge spies, various of the spies, historically. And one little thing about that, just a little anecdote, is that I've heard from various sources that when it comes to this VIP defile scandal, the Grove is where loads of this information was handed to the KGB, and they've still got it. The Russians, the Russians had in the 1970s and the 80s, not really so in the 90s because they were kind of falling apart over there, they had a tremendous dossier of all the VIP defiles and everything they've been up to. And at some point in the future, maybe that will come out via the Grove at Hammersmith. Anyway, look, right. Phil Zimmerman, sorry to end on that crazy note, but lovely to have you on. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tony. Pleasure.